Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. I just spoke with David Munz about his new book, A Single Sky, How an International Community Forged the Science of Radio Astronomy. This came out in 2013 with the MIT Press. Now, this is a very focused study of the emergence of a particular community within the history of the modern sciences, that is, a community of radio astronomers. The story spans the period from roughly the mid-1940s, to the mid-1960s, and it looks at the cooperation, the collaboration, the transdisciplinary practice across about seven different international sites that span from the UK, the US, Australia, all over the place. So it's a very focused study of this particular kind of scientific activity that emerged, but at the same time, it's also speaking to some very broad, very common themes and threads that have to do with how we both read and learn, how we write, and also how we practice the history of science. At stake here in this story is not just the history of a particular set of practices, that is, the practices of radio astronomers, but it's also some fundamental aspects of the craft of the history of science that include whether we are telling stories about one single national locality or transnational stories, how much we're focusing on the disciplinary pedagogy, the training, the apprenticeship, and other kinds of ways of focusing on the labor, and especially the early kind of labor of scientific disciplines and of their early practitioners. It's really interested in the material culture of science. It's interested in also reframing the emphasis from competition shaping Cold War sciences and really the modern sciences in general to more of a story about cooperation and collaboration. So there are some really important revisions that are at stake here in this story of radio astronomers, and it's a really interesting study because of that. I had a great time talking with David Munz about it, and I hope you enjoy as well. We're here today to talk with David Munz about his new book, A Single Sky, How an International Community Forged the Science of Radio Astronomy. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, David, and thank you so much for making time to talk with me tonight.
Thanks, Carla. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So, David, could you start us off by saying a little bit about what brought you into this field? How did you come to the history of science?
Well, my journey to the history of science was a sort of a rocky one, as it turns out. I was one of those strange undergraduates that actually had dual interests in physics, which I would do, of course, of the morning, and then history, which I would cross campus and do in the afternoon, and eventually just did both, and didn't realize at the time that you could actually do the history of science. In fact, I got into the history of science because I responded to a newspaper ad, of all things, that Nicholas Rasmussen, well known for his electron microscope book and his more recent book on drugs in the U.S., drug industry, he and the unit at the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney had decided to take out an ad in the newspaper to recruit people. And so I literally responded to an ad, "Are you interested in science plus history? Come and do the history of science with us." And that's how I got into the field. I'm the only person, evidently, to ever respond to the ad.
So that's fabulous. That is the first time I've asked this question to lots and lots of people, and I've never heard a response to a newspaper ad as being like that. And that's fabulous.
And I suspect you never will again. But it was fairly unique, as it turns out.
So congratulations on the recent publication of your first book. It's great, and it looks at the formation of a transnational radio astronomy community, and we'll talk about the importance of all of the elements of that seemingly simple description that turn out to be actually really important between the years of 1944 and 1964. So how did you come to this topic in particular as the focal point of your research for this book?
Yeah. So when I began my dissertation research and these kinds of things, I'd always had an interest, particularly in the physical sciences, but also particularly in the history of astronomy. Always been a very, 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 very interested in the history of astronomy, astronomical instruments. I found myself very much liking histories of material cultures, histories of instrumentation, histories of groups of people moving around. Because I'm originally from Australia, where radio astronomy is very big. Radio astronomy has always been one of sort of Australia's sort of flagship sciences, for various reasons, many of whom I go into in the book. Australia's always been particularly strong in astronomy, which is, on the one hand, very unusual. What the hell are astronomers doing in Australia? But in fact, is actually very sensible. Australia is it's a Western country. It has a unique place in the sphere. We have access to the Southern Hemisphere. Australia has always been very, very big and very strong in astronomy. So I was interested in a history of astronomy topic, interested in modern history. In fact, Nick Rasmussen suggested, well, what about the history of radio astronomy? That a little bit of work's been done on that recently. There's a very famous book, one of the most significant early books in the history and sociology of science, David Edge and Malcolm Olkay's Astronomy Transformed. Why don't you look at that from and see if there isn't something there, something new to say. And so I started out working with the radio astronomers in Australia, moved on to the ones in the United States, and eventually moved on to the ones in England as well. Because I did graduate school and indeed had jobs in all three locations, I was able to do substantial and deep research in each of those places. And so the book then became about tying these institutions together. And it became about what is the history of a broader community look like? What is the history of a field that really stretches around the globe very, very overtly? The astronomers are very particular in that they want to see the sky everywhere, but you cannot see the southern sky from the northern hemisphere and vice versa. So they, in the end, they had to cooperate with these kinds of things. And in that cooperation, they built a new kind of scientific community.
So this started out as a dissertation, am I right?
Yeah. So this started out as my PhD dissertation at Johns Hopkins.
Great. So David, can you say a little bit about that transition from dissertation to book? What was the process like for you? Were there any either major transformations of the project from one format to another, and or any major surprises along the way?
The transformation from dissertation to book, I think, is always a very tricky one. And in particular, the difficulties here were that when I wrote my dissertation, it was very much of a traditional case study dissertation. There's an introduction. It has five chapters. Each of those chapters deals with a specific site of radio astronomy. And so in some respects, it always felt like five articles. It was almost a classic science dissertation in this kind of ways. Five very discrete chapters that related to one another, but there was very little overlap realistically. And so you sort of had these five discrete elements, what to do with that. When I finished my dissertation, I got one of those amazing jobs where you had to teach a vast amount. So the dissertation project got put on hold for quite some time. The teaching 16 classes a year will do that to a person.
Wow.
I think I hold the record for the most number of classes taught in a single year in the history of science.
Wow.
But the But what that actually allowed me to do, interestingly enough, was for about 2 years, the dissertation and book project just got pushed to a side. There was just no way it was going to get done. And when I eventually came back to it, I tried to tinker with it. But in the end, the best thing to do was to simply pull it all apart and then reassemble it in the way that it should have been assembled in the first place, which is thematically. It's really a very distinct, the way the book turned out was instead of taking a case study approach, I took a fairly distinct chronological approach, simply putting things in chronological order and then noting how at the same time in different places, various communities were struggling with various types of issues and then narratively tried to push those things together, which in large respects involved a lot of rewriting and a tremendous amount of reorganization. And when it came to writing, and when it came to sort of editing the manuscript to turn it into a book with MIT and their Marjorie Avery and the entire team at MIT was fantastic. There was, as well as my reviewers, there was a lot of to and fro about the structure of the book and how you signposted and guided a reader through a story that kept shifting locations. That was one of its major problems, because it is difficult to, it's difficult, I think, to guide a reader when you're moving fairly rapidly, often from California through Australia. Suddenly you're in Cambridge, England. The next thing you know, you're back in New Zealand and you're sailing across this turf. And that is often very, very difficult. So I think one of the challenges of the book was actually to try and pull that off. And I hope that I've been mildly successful.
I mean, that I can imagine, I can't even imagine how challenging that would have been in the process of putting the book together. And this is actually something that I'll ask you about in a little bit of a different way later on, too. But at the same time, that great challenge of the book is also one of its greatest contributions, because I think, and this will come out over the course of our conversation today, but one of the really, really important kinds of work that the book does is to offer a kind of model and a methodological push toward thinking away from strictly localized, disciplinarily and or nationally bound stories into a kind of transnational, interwoven kind of a narrative, which is both, I get it, much, much more difficult to write, but also has to lend itself to a structure for the book itself that's fundamentally different from what we typically see in a, you know, single-sided history of science narrative, and also just seems like a fundamentally different kind of writing task.
Yeah, I think, you know, to the extent that I'm trying to offer up that kind of model, and I certainly am very, very interested. I'm very interested in topics that are internationally comparative, in sciences that are interdisciplinarily comparative. As I go into, for instance, in the back of the introduction, I think that history of science, particularly in recent history of science or history of science about recent science, has really struggled with what is a scientific discipline anymore. The boundaries about what is a scientist and what are their institutions and what are their disciplinary identities. These things have been either undermined or completely changed in the last sort of 40 or 50 years. So now disciplinarity only exists as a sort of a leftover artifact of the history of sciences. And I think a lot of scientists really embrace interdisciplinary work and they really move in much broader circles than they ever used to. And it creates then analytical problems for historians of science who are used to sort of these nice categories, right? We have an institution of science that exists in a national context, that exists in a disciplinary context. Those are nice sort of convenient boxes that we can frame our stories in. But I think sciences like radio astronomy, I refer at the end of the introduction to Jamie Cohen Cole's Great Stuff, where he does the same kind of things, that these scientists, they're not the same kinds of boxes that they used to be in, that people are used to. So I think for for a narrative and a storytelling way. That's creating interesting and new things that really reveal a lot about what's actually going on in these sciences.
So first things first, as we move into the body of the book itself, I've used the term radio astronomy a few times to talk about the nature of the book, and we've kind of glided past it. And speaking actually as a verbal footnote of gliding past and moving locations, you and the listeners might hear occasionally sounds that sound like furniture is moving upstairs. It sounds like it's because probably upstairs furniture is moving around. We'll just take that as part of our exciting trans-apartmental discourse here and work that into the experience that, oh, there we go, the experience of having these trans-local dialogues. Okay, so out of footnote. So radio astronomy, David, for listeners and also potential readers or readers who have actually come to the book already, who have never heard of that, what briefly is radio astronomy?
Right. Radio astronomy. Radio astronomy is one of the new forms of astronomy that really starts in the 1930s with the origins of radio. A radio astronomy is really astronomy at radio wavelengths. And one of the great challenges is that you have astronomers who are used to doing their work at optical wavelengths. They're used to seeing their subject. They see stars. They see spectra. They see through telescopes. They look at star charts. This is what astronomers do. Radio astronomers don't really, they see things, but mostly they listen to things. Radio astronomers, the information coming from stars at radio wavelengths is in the sound of what we would call radio noise. And exactly like you would have radio noise on your radio as you're going along the car in the middle of an electrical storm, so too the sun, planets, the galaxy, the universe itself produces a radio noise. And if you can learn to listen to that noise and develop instruments to listen to that noise and record that noise, you can start to do astronomy at radio wavelengths. And this is exactly what these pioneers did, beginning really with Karl Jansky, who was a radio engineer at Bell Labs in the 1930s, and then a whole slew of radio physicists, radio engineers, radar technicians at the end of World War II and in the beginning of the Cold War. They could build radio dishes and radar dishes. And when they pointed them at the sky, as very famously one of the major Australian radio astronomers who discovered solar noise from sunspot activity, actually, Joseph Pawsey, he would literally stick a radio antenna out of his window in his lab in Sydney and point it up at the sky and just sort of wave it around trying to get some measurements about what is this noise that I'm detecting. And the reason they could detect it is because the technology of radio receivers had improved so remarkably throughout the war because of radar. The technology of radar was that now suddenly noise from space became a limiting factor. It became the limit. You couldn't get more sensitive than that because the sun drowned you out. The stars drowned you out. And so they're a lot of the early experimental and research programs are actually trying to figure out where the noise is coming from and what's generating it and how you can chart it and what it all means.
Now, this is actually a fascinating story because it's not just, as you show early in the book and I think continue to develop throughout the book, this is not just about one community of people who are self-identifying as radio astronomers, but as you show, this story ultimately is really about changing meanings of astronomy, of what a telescope is, and it really changes astronomy as a science writ large, and it's not just about this one aspect of astronomy that we're talking about. And so there are pretty large ramifications and consequences to what's happening in these, in this 20-year period along these different sites that we're going to be looking at.
Yeah, no, I think so. And indeed, here I would refer back to the cover image, which there's a nice parallel here that we're on the radio talking about an image, which I think is actually half the battle. But the cover image to the book was a photo that I found at the Caltech archives. And it's one of those sort of great moments when you're doing research and you get this, there's this image and it's in a file somewhere and it's just a photo that somebody took at some point. I think it was for a newspaper article. And the cover image of the book shows John Bolton, one of the ex-Australian, ex-English astronomers currently in California. So he himself is a fascinating character in the whole thing, standing on the dish that he has largely built by himself, of the first radio telescope at Caltech in California. And in the background, just over the line of trees, is the Palomar Observatory, the largest optical telescope in the world. It's only been open less than a decade. Its size is almost unsurpassed. It's a great Art Deco optical visual telescope. One of the famed astronomers at Palomar, Edwin Hubble, calls it the astronomical center of the world. And yet, here's this photo of this, you know, rinky-dink radio telescope hand-built by this ex-radar guy that is now this sort of dominant thing. And the two go together. It's in the middle of, it's taken in the middle of the day. The subject of John Bolton and the telescope itself are both looking upwards. It's a very sort of open image. The dome is there. But the principles of both telescopes are somewhat the same, reflecting incoming information in the form of electromagnetic waves to a central point, either in optical wavelengths for the optical telescope or radio wavelengths for the radio telescope. But how does that come to be there? How does a radio telescope suddenly become a part of astronomy? How does an X-radar, a Navy lieutenant, I think he was, Royal Navy lieutenant radar operator, less than 10 years before, as suddenly part of the astronomical community at the astronomical center of the world, building new instruments of new forms. There's a very rapid transformation in a very old and venerable science. And that's sort of the cover image itself, I think, speaks to a lot of the themes that I tried to really bring out in the transforming nature of the science.
Now, you just mentioned Edwin Hubble, who actually turns out to be one of the main characters in the first chapter of the book. So I think he's a great place for us to start.
Excellent. This
now, a lot of the first chapter of the book focuses on Hubble, who is one of the most famous astronomers in his generation, as you tell us in the book. You contrast him here with another astronomer, a young astronomer named Custer Baum at Caltech at the end of World War II, and they're making different decisions in the context of this changing landscape for scientists, for people who are self-identifying as scientists and working in the sciences in the context of the Cold War. Now, you set up this situation in this chapter where Hubble and Baum are actually representing two approaches to astronomy and really to the sciences more generally as individuals who choose between what we might consider to be pure research and what we might consider to be industry after the war. You actually go on in this chapter to really challenge these poles and show that you're really showing how the context that you're looking at in this part of the book is working in part to take these previously distinct categories like pure and applied science, university and industry, and starting to mix them up. And this is one of many cases of mixing that we're going to see through the book. But I think this is a good place to perhaps start and explore one of the major threads of the book, which is this sort of how to situate this story of this emerging radio astronomy community within a larger discourse of Cold War science. So you're doing work in this part of the book especially, but also, you know, throughout the other chapters, that really takes a dominant narrative of Cold War science as sort of bound up with and bound to the needs and the whims of the military-industrial complex, and using cases like Baum and Hubble, and using cases like some of these other radio or the emerging community of radio astronomers to really challenge how we think about Cold War science and especially the role of the individual making decisions within that. So I wonder if you could use this as a place to talk a little bit about this as one of the many major themes of the book, how you're situating your study in the context of how we understand the sciences in the Cold War.
Yeah. No, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'm building on, and well, any story of Cold War physical sciences, you know, begins with David Kaiser's really foundational work in establishing the physicists and how the physicists become this very dominant group, and how the physicists as a community, and particularly as a educational regime, how that really changes the sheer number, the sheer ballooning size of physics. And what I really took from that was that, and David Kaiser and I, to give him due credit, he really pointed out that what I was trying to do was sort of the exact opposite. I was doing the inversion of that story, doing the inversion of the physics story. And that really rang a lot of bells. These radar operators, these radio physicists right at the end of World War II, should have, one would think, they should have done exactly what Custer Baum did. And you can imagine, Custer Baum was a student at Caltech. He was in this idyllic educational environment, and yet he leaves it to go work for industry. Money was a very big lure, but he had jobs. He had offers of three or four major jobs from major industry concerns, from Berkeley, and from Caltech itself. So here's a young man, a young astronomer, with many options. And so one of the questions is always, why do people go into where they're going? At the end of World War II, anyone involved with radar has more options than they would probably know what to do with. So the question becomes is, why, if you're in radar, why would you go into astronomy? It can't be lucrative. What exactly is drawing these very few people into astronomy? And the comparison there between Hubble and Custer Baum is, I think, a nice one, because it just sort of centralizes it and gives a nice focus for these extremes. That within a very short period of time, right at the end of the war, people are really going off to make decisions that they don't know what the consequences are. I think one of the real issues in the history of science is that we often know what it is that we're looking for. We know where the success story is going to come. But one of the things I really wanted to do, particularly in this first chapter, was really give this sense that at this particular point in time, there were many options on the table for many, many people. And why certain people chose certain avenues is somewhat unexpected, but really speaks to the hearts and the values that they hold as scientists, and really what it was that they were going in for. The other great advantage about starting off with that is then one of the major point at which I tie it all together is the epidemiological point, right? because Hubble and Custer Baum, along with all of the others, all the other characters in this chapter, the reader really meets most of the major characters that they're going to meet. They're even early on, they are related epidemiologically. They are all connected through one another. And so what I really wanted to establish there was, yes, there is a range of options for astronomers, for radio physicists, for radar operators, for institutions, for disciplines. There's a range of options. And when you get a coherent field that seems an unlikely outcome from that, they're related to one another somehow. The community is pulling them together. Their relations are pulling them together. Even as the military-industrial complex is luring many of them off to other sides. So, for example, the classic contrast is between Luis Alvarez, who goes off to be, you know, one of the most successful linear accelerator, cyclotron physics guys in California. He's his friend at the radiation laboratory at MIT is Edward Bowen from England, who goes off to the radio physics lab in Australia. And Edward Bowen goes into radio astronomy, and Alvarez goes into accelerating particles. And Bowen attempts to accelerate particles too. That is a logical outcome, a reasonable outcome of what he's attempting to do. How then does Alvarez stay in physics, but Bowen ends up being the leader of one of the most successful and significant radio astronomy groups within a decade, in a very, very short period of time? Well, that's sort of where that's going.
Right, and the next chapter actually opens with this attempt, this Australian effort to develop an electron accelerator. And so this brings us really nicely into this next chapter of the book. But I just want to, as a footnote, signal for listeners who may not have had a chance to read the book, when you're talking about epidemiology, this is actually really interesting because you're not talking about epidemiology in terms of a field of medical public health study. You're using epidemiology in that part of the book as a metaphor, I think, to explain the transformations of this community, the scientific community. So it's really, it's another point in the book in which in a relatively concise work, you're introducing methodological tools that could potentially be taken up and used in all kinds of different studies by readers of the book. And so this is worth signaling, I think. So this attempt in Australia to develop an electron accelerator ultimately isn't super successful, but brings us into a really fascinating part of the story in Chapter 2. So Chapter 2 looks at early efforts to study radio noise from the sun and stars, so i.e. radio astronomy, and it looks at the formation of this really important concept that you've been talking about that's so central to the work that the book is doing, and that is the emergence of a community. And community here is going to be a very important word for us. It's a very important term. It's not just a word that we're using to describe a group of people. It actually has very strong conceptual resonance for the work that the book does. So this brings us to also one of the major axes of the book, as you call them at the beginning of the book. This is the importance of scientific communities transcending disciplinary and national boundaries. So you argue in this part of the book here that having, and you mentioned this already a little bit earlier, but having singular national or singular disciplinary narratives has really skewed in some ways our entire picture of the history of science. And often in the context of Cold War science, that's been a picture that's been skewed to the story of the U.S. Now, what you're showing in this chapter of the book is really the deeply transnational history of radio astronomy. The events that formed this science took place simultaneously at, get ready, I'm going to list them, the Australia Radio Physics Laboratory in Sydney, 1, the Physics Department at University of Manchester, 2, and this is a shout out to everyone who's at the History of Science meeting in Manchester right now.
True.
Thinking of you.
I wish I could be there because it'd be cooler in Manchester than this in New York.
So University of Manchester, 3, Cavendish Library at Cambridge, 4, Leiden Observatory in the Netherlands, 5, Harvard College Observatory in Massachusetts, 6, Caltech, 7, New National Radio Astronomy Observatory in West Virginia. And I say that not just to put out there each of these individual, not just to be pedantic, but rather to show and to really put out there for listeners what the range of sites is that you're talking about, and also simultaneously how challenging I can imagine as a reader this is to tell a story that's dependent on really meaningful work in not just one site, but did I count 7 sites? Okay, so but what I'd love to ask you about, because this is so important, it seems, to the work that the book is doing, is really about this range. And I have kind of 2 major questions about this to start us off and to talk about this chapter. First, what were some of the challenges for you in doing this kind of transnational history of science? And also, could you talk a little bit about this as a kind of methodological cause, maybe not cause is perhaps the wrong word, but it seems like moving us toward a more transnational picture of the history of science is an important part of what you're trying to do, not just with this study, but as a practicing historian of science. So can you talk about that a little bit as it shapes what you're trying to do in this part of the book? And can you also talk about some of the challenges for you of doing that kind of a cross-translocal research?
I probably shouldn't use the word cause, but I'm going to use the word cause.
Okay, because, sorry, you can blame
because,
me.
You know, if you can't be honest about this kind of thing, what can you be? I think it is a cause. I think there is a cause. I think a lot of the early work that I did in graduate school was, you know, we've all read lots of books, and they're all these nice disciplinary studies, which reveal a lot about sciences. And there are nice national studies, they reveal a lot too. And I think that as the field of the history of science is maturing and changing, and we've been through our philosophical turn and our sociological turn and our empiricist turn and this turn, that turn, and I think another turn that we really should go through is a turn towards both transnational and interdisciplinary kinds of stories, particularly for the Cold War era. I think that what happens is that just reflects reality. It reflects a historical change that sciences become less disciplinarily specific and they become more interdisciplinarily community oriented. One of the great debates we've currently had in the history of science is all about what are boundaries, what are knowledge boundaries, what are the disciplinary boundaries, how do people establish and defend boundaries of their work, their practice, their instrument. These boundary discussions have been bounded. A community discussion, I think, looks at that boundary problem from the other way around. We look at who is attempting to come into the community? Who is attempting to join forces with someone else? And why are they attempting to do it? When you have a subject like radio noise from space, this is encouraging a whole range of people to come towards this very amorphous field that nobody knows what it is. It's called noise for the first 4 or 5 years. It's not called radio astronomy. It's called radio noise. They literally do not know what to call it. It's amorphous. It's noise. It's this background signal that you get. But you have people from rockets who are interested in rockets. You have optical astronomers. You have radio physicists. You have radio engineers. You have Americans. You have Australians. You have Brits. You have the Dutch. All of these people have their own vested interests at their own local institutions, local disciplinary communities, and they all come together. Methodologically, then, one of the causes I would like to see is more internationally comparative work, because science doesn't exist nationally specifically. Science always attempts to make universal claims. Science always at least attempts to be transportable to other places. Scientists want their work to be read by other people. National boundaries are incredibly important for the funding of science. Though, as the radio astronomy story tells, there are actually ways in which you can get around that too. The Australian Radio Telescope very famously was half funded by an American foundation. National boundaries play a much more dubious role in the creation of scientific instruments, creation of scientists, creation of knowledge, than I think we've always often been very comfortable with or been willing to admit. But I think once you cross those boundaries and you deal with cases where the scientists themselves are constantly crossing those boundaries, in the radio astronomy story, basically everyone goes everywhere. Again, John Bolton on the cover is a great example. Starts out as a radar operator in Britain, moves to Australia, eventually moves to Caltech, moves back to Australia as the director of the Parkes Radio Telescope. He did three countries in less than a decade. Joe Pawsey is the same. He eventually becomes the Australian director to the National American Radio Astronomy Observatory. Tragically, he dies about 2 weeks after he gets the appointment. But that a national laboratory, a particularly nationalist laboratory, is appointing an international person speaks to the nature of radio astronomy as an international scientific community rather than a purely national enterprise. And that's sort of one of the big things. But the challenges there are to how you really bring those characters together. They have to be overlapping with one another. And the radio astronomers were an excellent example of groups of scientists who are constantly moving, communicating with one another, and crossing boundaries of all manner of sorts. The great example, and I think it's in chapter two, but the great example is when the Royal Astronomical Society comes and has a look at the new models for Jodrell Bank, which is outside of Manchester, and Bernard Lovell's grand plans for a grand radio telescope. The president of the Royal Astronomical Society makes a comment like, you know, what great work you've been doing in observational astronomy, in radio astronomy, brackets, all physics. He literally puts the brackets, all physics, into his speech because he honestly doesn't know. It's both. It's neither. It's this cross-disciplinary thing which is emerging right before his eyes. He's literally been there for a week, for a weekend conference, and this new form of the organization of science is emerging right before his eyes.
Now, do you think that the nature of the object of study for them, i.e. the sky, as you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, lends itself to this kind of collaboration, this need for this kind of collaboration, or rather cooperation, as you put it in this chapter? Or do you think this is something that actually characterizes the sciences writ large in this period?
I think that there are, I think one of the other great asymmetries of the sort of history of Cold War sciences to date, particularly, and, you know, all the fantastic work that's really been done on the sciences and the military-industrial complex, the rise of big physics, the rise of big science, the rise of big biomedicine, these are, you know, hugely transformative stories that have very much focused upon the role of the nation state and the role of the military-industrial complex in particular, how that has changed the nature of scientific work, the nature of scientific discovery, the nature of scientific instruments. I think that around that story, or even perhaps weaved through that story, are other scientists who very particularly either overtly reject the military-industrial complex, and this is the radio astronomers are fundamentally here. They should be part of the military-industrial complex. They were all part of it during the war. They specifically reject it at the end of the war. That's one of their major transformative moments. There's an incident later on in the book where one of the radio astronomers is talking to his superior about how to get money for a giant radio telescope, and his superior goes, well, can we sell it to defense? And the radio astronomer goes, well, there's really no way to sell it to defense. We really aren't doing that. We couldn't honestly claim to be part of that. There is another famous incident with Lovell in the end, where he's taken money from the military-industrial complex in the late 1950s, but never does anything. He takes their money, and a year later, this lieutenant writes to him and says, you know, well, did anything ever come of that money we sent you? Yeah, well, we haven't really done the work yet, says Lovell. And about a year later, a captain, and this is, of course, nicely how the military-industrial complex works, a captain writes again going, have you done anything with all the money we sent you? No, says Lovell, and I don't really think we can. And so he just sends the money back in the end. That the radio astronomers are going, like, they're sending money back to the military-industrial complex? I don't believe any physicist ever did that. But this is, you know, that strikes me as being fairly unique in that kind of way. But I think that there are stories where that, during the Cold War, of scientists who really are far more outside the military-industrial complex than I think a lot of the dominant narratives that we deal with regularly have sort of given them credit for. And so, you know, this is a case in point, might be useful in correcting some of that asymmetry, I would suggest.
Okay, thank you. And I'll just signal also for listeners, I won't ask you to talk too much about this, but another kind of correction that you offer for dominant discourses of the history of science is also in this chapter. And this is in emphasizing the importance of cooperation rather than competition in driving recent science, and specifically taking on the emphasis on competition as it manifests in the work of Thomas Kuhn, who's been so influential for many of us who are trained in the history of science. And so I mention this just to signal this for listeners who might be interested in this aspect of historiography of science, to look in particular at Chapter 2, because there's a very in-depth discussion of that there. So one of the things that also comes up in this part of the book, and this is Chapter 2 and also Chapter 3 focus on this, is an emphasis on the importance of student training and pedagogy in shaping the emergence of this community and in really shaping the sciences in this period. So you mention at the end of Chapter 2 the importance of student recruitment and training to helping shape the interdisciplinary radio astronomy community in the U.S. and in Britain. And that story and that emphasis on the importance of students and training and pedagogy really continues throughout the next chapter. This is, in fact, one of the major axes of the book that you set out at the beginning, the importance of the recruitment and training of students. And a focus on pedagogy is a way to get at the labor of science in this particular context. Now, you talk about a lot of aspects of this in this part of the book, and I won't ask you to recreate the story for us, and I'm hoping that listeners will go and read the book themselves to get the fully fleshed out story. But there are a number of ways in which you're showing through the apprenticeship and the institution of apprenticeship, and through other aspects of examination and curricular reform and graduate student recruitment, this discipline, not discipline, that's in fact probably the exact wrong word to describe it, but this community, rather, of radio astronomers is really emerging, and this is really central to what's happening. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that in the context of the work that you're doing in this part of the book.
Yeah, no, one of the interesting parts, I think, of the formation of new scientific communities like the radio astronomy community is the notion of that it very rapidly took shape from really very strange guys doing their own thing. 1945, 1946. By the mid-1950s, they have institutions, they have radio observatories, they have PhD programs, they have a fully fledged scientific organization. And one of the interesting parts from that was how much of that work I kept noticing was really done by the students of the radio astronomers themselves. The radio astronomers are leading, but a lot of their students are doing this, particularly at the early radio astronomy program at Harvard Observatory, where they form a graduate program in radio astronomy as early as 1952. Caltech's formed very shortly thereafter. Lovell's in the University of Manchester and the one in Cambridge are also by the late 1940s. Very much from the outset, even before they really have a name for the thing, they have PhD students, they have graduate programs, they have research programs that are very much dealing with graduate student training and recruitment and training. And here, the place that I really, or the work that's just foundational whenever you talk about pedagogy or student recruitment and training is, of course, Andrew Warrick's Masters of Theory, which really just turned my whole thinking around when I read that book about the power or the analytical power that dealing not with the outcomes of science, but dealing with the labor and the productive nature of scientific work. That one of the major things, and here also Kathy Olesko is also great in this, that we've got to concentrate on the labor of science rather than just the outcomes of science. scientific papers, dissertations, these kinds of things are important. But the students themselves are doing a lot of the work at the coal face, at the side of the telescope. And I really wanted to see, and I was very taken with how overlapping that process was, that the process of building a new scientific community, the process of building a whole new field of science, what are its instruments, what are its questions, what are its research focuses, what are its institutions, what are its funding sources, these things were bound up with what are students, what work are students doing, how do we train students, what should students be trained on, how do we what work do students do in programs, and particularly in chapter 3, I think I really go into the disciples of science. And so instead of going in for what are the disciplines of science, I'm really going in for what are the disciples of science. What are the young disciples doing? How are they learning the values of the new scientific community? How are they imparted those values? How do they impart them on in each of the various ways they're going? And here in particular, the site at Jodrell Bank in England speaks volumes, I think, about how the program itself and the field itself is learning from its exposure with the process of putting through graduate students through their paces. And there are some examples of exams and things which are always great, exam questions. And then also turning to the Harvard radio astronomy case, where the major instruments at the Harvard Observatory in the end become, the phrase they use is, training instruments. They don't have world-class research instruments by the 1940s and 50s anymore. They have training instruments. They only have instruments that are good for student training. But a radio telescope can take that training instrument and make it into a research instrument. But no one at Harvard knows how to use a radio telescope. They actually have to hire a physicist from the physics department and get in a visiting professor from Australia and another one from the Netherlands in order to teach not only themselves but also their graduate students how to do radio astronomy, because nobody knows. So you have world-class astronomers who in effect become as much graduate students as the graduate students that they are teaching. They themselves learn what that means. And that's sort of one of the what I would suggest is one of the sort of the big point counterpoints of the book, big point counterpoint of the narrative is that as the radio physicists learn to be astronomers, so the optical astronomers learn to be radio astronomers. And so you have this sort of to and fro as people exchange, as they visit, as they go and teach classes at someone else's institutions. And this happened everywhere, particularly with the Australians, as it turns out, as I never get tired of pointing out. By the 1950s, you now have Australian radio physicists teaching at these world-class universities in astronomy. But they're trained as radio physicists. If we're looking at what are the boundaries of things, if we're looking at disciplines of things, these people are not disciplinarily codified to be at these programs, and yet there they are, and cooperating in building textbooks, building exams, building lecture courses. That's what they're doing.
Well, David, thank you so much. I think I have, there's one final thing I want to ask you about before we come to the conclusion of our conversation. And this really takes us into one of the major themes of the fourth and fifth chapters of the book. And this is the importance of material culture and a focus on instruments and scientific instrumentality to the story that you're telling about the creation of the scientific community. So this is another, and perhaps the last one I want to ask you about, major, major access of the book is this focus on instruments and material culture. One of the most important aspects of this is the development of giant radio telescopes. And this is probably anyone who's familiar with radio astronomy, this is probably one of the first images that pops into their head is precisely the kind of giant radio telescope that's shown on the cover of the book that we think of Jodie Foster and sci-fi movies. At least for me, that was the first image that came to mind. It's these giant
for all my relatives too.
Right. So this is a really important kind of work that the book is doing. So chapter four looks at both chapters look at a context between the mid-1950s and mid-1960s, where five major groups of radio astronomers are building these large radio telescopes. And you're arguing in this part of the book, these final two body chapters, that the whole process of planning, of funding, of operating these giant machines builds an interdisciplinary and international community of radio astronomers, fixing what you call their moral economy. Now, chapter four focuses on the four major first-generation radio telescopes that were designed, funded, and built within 10 years. So it's a relatively rapid process. And Chapter 5 looks at a counterpoint to these four big radio telescopes examined in the previous chapter by looking at the American National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is explicitly defined as a very national project in contradistinction to the previous four. Now, this is an important part of the story, so I just want to give you an opportunity to talk about this a little bit, as much as you'd like, really. But one of the major points that comes up in these chapters, really emphasizing and honoring the importance of these machines in terms of material culture, is the design of them. So there's some degree of argument over whether these telescopes should be designed in a way that's parabolic, or whether they should be designed in a way that's, I'm going to try this, so bear with me, interferometric. Right?
Interferometric.
So parabolic or interferometric design, this comes up for them in terms of, this is a decision on which some major money and international relationships hinge, and et cetera, et cetera. So could you talk for a little bit about these big telescopes? Why so big? First of all, what was the big deal about over design? And what are the major take-home lessons that you'd like us to take away from this emphasis on the material culture of science as instantiated in these major radiometric telescopes?
Yeah. I think that I think it's right. There's one of the great transformations is that within 10 years, within a decade, the radio astronomers go from isolated, small scale, several like to celebrate the Cavendish style, these littered small laboratories of one or two researchers doing their hokey experiments, to this international big science. Like, radio astronomy, as Alvin Weinberg, the director of Brookhaven, always did, radio astronomy becomes the poster child for big science, right up there with cyclotrons, right up there with big oceanography. Radio astronomy is one of the biggest of the big sciences in the Cold War, and yet it isn't the same as the other ones, not least of which because it doesn't largely take money from the military-industrial complex to fund it. So one of the usual funding sources is notably absent in the radio astronomy story. The other thing that happens is that very rapidly, in at least five or six places, one or two designs of radio telescope very much solidify as being that. But again, in retrospect, we know that one of the great successes comes not from the dominant form of radio telescope, the parabolic form of radio telescope, the big dish, which has been in many. Which has been in both Judy Foster and, of course, in James Bond movies. There's a very famous fight scene over the Arecibo dish, as it turns out. It's the other good movie one to go for. That is not what wins astronomy its Nobel Prize with Martin Ryle. Martin Ryle pioneers the interferometer, and an interferometer is an array, a long, what looks like a fence, 2 and 3 mile long fences set perpendicular to one another that gains far greater resolution than the parabola, and that's one of the things that helps Martin Ryle gain his Nobel Prize. So in terms of the dominant form of instrument at the time, in retrospect, it wasn't at all. But the around the world, again, with a lot of these radio telescopes being built simultaneously, it really evinced for me the way in which the international community was working. The one of the ways in which a science like radio astronomy, or a group of scientists like the radio astronomers, is able to build numerous giant, very expensive facilities very rapidly is that they are all mutually supporting one another. In particular, on the argument that each of these instruments is part of an international network of science, that that one telescope isn't sufficient. It's never sufficient. They all have to go together. They all cooperate with one another. There are designs that are sent backwards and forwards from most of the major groups. Most of the major groups have players that go backwards and forwards. Cooperation and community helps them build these giant radio telescopes in the same as a nice counterpoint to the giant cyclotrons and the giant rockets that are being built by, again, actually rather interdisciplinary groups, but are also very nationalistically focused. So this then brings out another aspect, I think, of Cold War science, which I hope the radio astronomy story really exposes a lot more of, that there's a lot more scientific cooperation and a lot more community going on in the Cold War than perhaps we have to date appreciated.
Well, David, thank you so much. There's a ton of material that we didn't have a chance to talk about in the context of the book. And there's also a conclusion that we haven't mentioned that talks about, among other things, one of the two films, that bookend
yes.
the story. So there are really interesting elements here of, you know, how this story refracts into popular culture. You talk about how to understand this in the context of big science. There's a lot in the book that readers will find that we didn't have a chance, have time to talk about. It's a very rich study. So is there anything in particular that you would like to mention that we didn't have a chance to talk about?
Given that these interviews, I think, are, you know, for not necessarily an Australian audience, but for everyone else, yes, very, very famously, and not all sciences can lay claim to this, there is, in fact, a very funny movie about the Parkes radio telescope called The Dish, which came out by this group of very the Australian equivalent of like Saturday Night Live. They wrote this movie that they were able to produce and have this very charming, very funny story. And this movie that came out in 2000 in Australia. But that kind of cultural import of the subject of astronomy in Australia, I think, also speaks to that. But it's if anyone hasn't seen The Dish, I recommend it to everyone.
Okay, I'll try to remember to put a link to that in the post.
Absolutely.
The Dish. Okay. So, David, now that this book is out, and congratulations again on the book, what's next for you? What current project or projects are inspiring you?
Well, as it turns out, I mentioned this, and I came across it, and this is again one of those sort of lucky stories. But I came across it in the archives that when the radio astronomers were attempting to get funding for their radio telescope, they wrote to the Rockefeller Foundation. And the Rockefeller Foundation actually, in the end, gave them $250,000 to fund the giant radio telescope in Australia. I mean, in that file, there was another letter several years later from another group of scientists in Australia who said, in effect, you funded the Australian giant radio telescope. Please, would you like to also fund our phytotron? And I'm going, I don't even know what a phytotron is. What is a phytotron? I have no idea. So I go and I ask Nick Rasmussen, who of course knows all things. And Nick Rasmussen says, I have a sort of some like climate controlled greenhouse thing. Yeah, they were very big for a time. And so I go and look into that. And then discover that in 1957, just before Sputnik, the American National Science Foundation was going to be giving you its biggest grant yet, and it was going to be giving money for four subject areas: radio astronomy, to build the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, for centralized computing laboratories, so big computing centers, for nuclear reactors, and nuclear industrial research, and controlled environmental laboratories. And so this really struck me, and so I've gone off and I've begun to write the history of phytotrons, of these computer-controlled, fully hermetically sealed greenhouses that could produce and reproduce all of the environmental variables in which plants grew and developed. And the first one of these phytotrons, because they were given this very very sexy name one day by none other than Robert Millikan of the famed Millikan oil drop experiment thing. Robert Millikan actually claimed they were going to be bigger than the atomic bomb at one point, believe it or not, which is something for a Nobel Prize winner in physics to say. But phytotrons started at Caltech under a scientist called a botanist and plant physiologist called Fritz Wendt. And then eventually 30 or 40 phytotrons were built around the world, several in the US, one in Australia, a big one in France, a very big one in the Soviet Union. These climate-controlled biological and botanical laboratories changed form. Fritz went on to build the famous Climatron, which is at the Missouri Botanical Garden. And then most recently, ecologists have reinvented it again. The Ecotron has just opened at Imperial College in London and another one at Montpellier in France to do controlled climate ecological studies. And so there's a whole series of biological trons which have sort of emerged. And this story is almost unknown. It's almost completely unknown. I was talking to Susan Lindy about this. And she's going, how have I never heard of these things? And I'm going, no one's heard of these things. It's been totally great. That project is coming along very nicely, and hoping to have another book length study of again multiple phytotrons in multiple areas, dealing with many of the same kinds of issues, but also not. But again, it's this. In the end, it becomes this sort of quartet of sciences, which I think are the other Cold War story, which are centralized computing facilities, teaching nuclear reactors, which is what I would like my next book to be on, the nuclear reactors that were built to teach people how to build and use nuclear reactors, which is, in a sense, the origins of nuclear engineering programs, a very big one at North Carolina State, for instance, which also has a big phytotron funded by Big Tobacco. R.J. Reynolds and the Camel funded the North Carolina phytotron. The NSF funded the University of Wisconsin Biotron, which still operates. The Public of Missouri funded the Climatron, and Campbell Soup Company and the Earhart Foundation founded the original phytotron at Caltech. Original phytotron. It was designed to do research into tomatoes that could be grown in warm conditions.
Oh.
So yeah. And so this whole very, very interesting thing. So at the same time as these phytotronists are doing research into the whole organism, right down in the same department at Caltech, you have Max Delbruck and you have Boris Afutsi, and you have James Watson for 2 years as a postdoc. You have the beginnings of molecular biology in the exact same department as you have the largest biological laboratory at Caltech for a number of years, Caltech's phytotron. And this is the new story.
Well, David, that's fabulous. So I already can tell that I'll be talking with you again when that book comes out. So get to writing so that we can
I will get to writing as soon as we can.
Well, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. And thanks for taking the time. Best of luck with the next project.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us, and see you next time.